Blog Talk Radio.
And I'm your host, Poke Runyon. This is the Hermetic Hour. Tonight we will be recapping and reviewing Adonia, our 37th consecutive presentation of the reconstructed ancient Canaanite summer solstice rite. And this follows upon our celebration of the rite at Mount Silvat Temple and Hermitage in Pasadena on the 18th. And for those of you who have our film, The Rites of Magic, this is the seasonal ceremony depicted in that film. So tune in tonight and we'll dance around the circle with Prince Baal as he asks, "Who drinks with me?" Yeah. Now, let's have some call-ins tonight. You folks have been kind of holding on to your questions out there, and this is a good time to call in and ask them. Our guest call-in number is area code 347-857-1830. So give us a call anytime during the show, and we will we'll try to answer your questions for you. Now, I want to explain first why we do these Neo-Canaanite or reconstructed Phoenician, ancient Phoenician ceremonies four times a year, why we do them, what the purpose of it is, and give you some idea of how they came about, and primarily focus on Adonia, which was the first one we ever did, by the way. It's the summer solstice, the death of the Ur King. That was the first one we did back in 1974. And we have a show that we've done on each one of these. One of our blog talk shows that you can go back in the archives and listen to the podcast on. But we want to give you an idea about why we do them and what's the purpose of them and how they came about. So let me say this: the climate, the ecology, and the seasonal cycle in Southern California is Mediterranean. It's virtually identical with the seasonal cycle in the Holy Land. In fact, if you look at the vegetation and even the way the map lays out, we're in a way kind of a little miniature, except we're on the west coast of the Pacific Ocean, and they're on the west coast with the Mediterranean. But other than that, it's very, very similar. We have up there in the Lebanon, you know, Mount Zaphon up there in the northern part of it, up there in what's now Syria. That's kind of like our Mount Shasta up there. And then you get down toward the south, and we have the Salton Sea, which is like the Dead Sea, and it's very similar, and the vegetation is similar. And in Southern California, the season of death, the season of real misery is the summer. Everything dries up, and we have the even if not a drought year, it dries up, and so the sun at that time becomes almost like the enemy, and so from a standpoint of a seasonal rituals, our seasonal rituals should be tuned to how our seasons actually work. Now, originally, The ancient Canaanite seasonal ceremonies were agricultural. In other words, they were this was an agricultural society, whereas the Hebrews were primarily herdsmen. They were nomads, and so they had a different the Hebrews had a different slant on ecology and a different slant on a seasonal ceremony cycle, in a sense. But they, even so, they inherited this seasonal cycle that was going in Melchizedek's time. That was before Solomon, way back before Moses. This was an agricultural cycle, and it involved the planting and the reaping, and then the rains and the storms in winter, and then the birth of the lambs and the nascent vegetation in the spring. And this cycle had a lot of influence even on into the Bible, and it was actually what lay behind the Phoenician pantheon, which was eventually underlaid a lot of what's in the Bible. Now, something that we should admit to was that when the OTA got started back in 1969-70, when we got started, this was an era, well, you want to call it the psychedelic era. It was also an era of great social rebellion, and people were seeking to find spirituality in exotic and unusual ways, and traditional religion was sort of put in the background. We were all in experimental mode, and what was coming in at that time was the witchcraft movement, the Wiccan movement, the beginnings of the neo-pagan movement. And of course, as those of you who have followed our program and know something about our background, the beginning of the neo-pagan movement in Southern California and in the whole country, as far as that's concerned, was originally Fred Adams and Svetlana Buterin's Farifaria, which we were very closely associated with and still are, by the way. And at first, this was not, and during this period, this was before radical feminism took over somewhat distorted the pagan process. This, when the beginning of paganism in America, around about that time, with the witchcraft community and Farifarians and all this, nature and fertility and of course sexual liberation, obviously, and all of this was very much in vogue. And so, consequently, when I first had my vision and I wanted to get started building the OTA, I tended to take a kind of a witchcraft perspective on magic, and I was coming in fresh. I wasn't, wasn't a former Golden Dawn member at that time, and I wasn't, I didn't, What I knew about magic, I got from the Saragossa manuscript and Paul Christian's History and Practice of Magic, and a little bit of Eliphas Levy and Arthur Edward Waite, and so I did. And I wasn't all steeped in the Victorian magical tradition, which I got into later. So consequently, I took a neo-pagan perspective on this, because this was what was in the air at the time. This was what we were doing. We didn't think of ourselves as stodgy biblical Victorian type. We weren't doing all this very, very well. I don't mean to downplay masonry, because masonry is very important, but this magic was so Masonic that it was almost in many ways indistinguishable from Masonic ceremonies. And so we wanted to have a magical organization that was essentially neo-pagan. And I wasn't rebelling against Christianity. Actually, I think Jesus' philosophy is wonderful, and I think Jesus is one of the greatest mystical philosophers that ever lived. I'd put him ahead of Buddha and ahead of Muhammad, peace be unto him, because I really think. But on the other hand, the church, any kind of organized Christianity, I just couldn't go. I mean, I just couldn't. So I was more into the neo-pagan thing, and I thought we should have something that we should have the magical tradition, Solomon's tradition, the medieval type of grand sorcery and all of that. But let's do it in a neo-pagan way. That was the way I wanted to do it. This was the way I felt about it. I'd contacted the goddess Astarte, and she was, oh boy. I brought Astarte involved, a visible appearance in the triangle of art, and maybe I got possessed by them, and ended up recreating a modern version of their religion. So I suppose I could say that. But I really wanted to do this, and I wanted to do it this way. I wanted to have a bridge between the neo-pagan community, which was really, really going strong at that time, and the ceremonial magic idea, the ceremonial magic tradition. And so the way to do this, I thought, and was inspired to do this, is let's go back and let's take a look at Solomon, who is kind of mythical in some ways. Maybe he's kind of mythical, but take a look at Solomon, and let's say just what was Solomon doing, and how was he doing it, if we take the myth of Solomon seriously. Well, you read the Bible, Solomon built a temple to Astarte. Solomon was practicing. He was a pagan, and I don't think there's any argument about that, because as I say, it's just right there in the Bible. He went after what they call strange gods, and of course the Levites didn't like it and all that. But Solomon is considered the great magician, not just in the Jewish and Christian tradition, but also in the Muslim tradition. Solomon is the great wizard. He's the Merlin of the Middle East, the Merlin of the Bible. And let's look at what was Solomon's secret magical religion. What was the religion that Solomon was probably doing his magic with? Well, it would pretty obviously, if I got the Temple of Astarte here, and of course Prince Baal is Astarte's consort, and they happen to be also translated as two two medieval so-called demons in the Goetia, and that's Baal and Astaroth, and so that's the ceremonial magic link right there. So let's take a look, okay? What was the secret magical religion behind Solomon and that magic? Well, if we go back in the Bible to a character called Melchizedek. Now, Melchizedek is very, 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 very important. Melchizedek was the Phoenician or Canaanite high priest, a high priest of El, now the Most High God, which is really God, a priest of God, and that's way above Baal and Astarte and all that. That's a priest of El. In Salem, and that was old Jerusalem, and he is the power and the dispensation of our great old patriarch Abraham. Melchizedek gave Abraham communion. That was a pagan communion. That was El, that was long before Yahweh, and that was El. And by the way, the 10 lost tribes of Israel were still worshiping El. Not Yahweh. Yahweh was a latecomer. But, so Melchizedek was a Canaanite. And Melchizedek was a priest of El. So, and Melchizedek, by the way, that means priest king. That's Malach Zadok. And for those of you who are into ancient languages or whatever, that's what it means. It means priest king. Now, it's interesting to note, those of you who, we have a number of members in the OTA that are still Christian, and that's fine with it. You should, if you're a Christian and you're into our thing, you might want to look into the New Testament and count the number of times that Jesus has been declared a priest after the order of Melchizedek. Yeah, check that out. And that, then start to wondering just what John the Baptist's connection was, and you're into something very, very interesting there. Anyway, but back to our idea here. So, here we had a secret magical religion behind the Bible, interplayed with the Bible, and of course, as a lot of you know, when you take your obligation in the OTA, your hands are on the Bible, but it's open to the Song of Solomon. Your hands are on the Bible, open to the Song of Solomon. That's what you take your, and that's very, very Canaanite and very, very much along the line of what we're talking about. So, and also I might point out to you that the Song of Solomon, the Shad Sharim, is the secret heart of the Zohar. And that wasn't known until fairly recently. But if you have one of those wonderful 22-volume sets of the Zohar that Rabbi Berg sells for such a wonderful price. Oh, I love them. You'll find out. Just go through your Zohar and check out all the references to the Shad Sharim, and you will be enlightened. Now, anyway, so what we have here is a secret magical religion that is behind the Bible. And it was definitely Solomon. Because remember, Solomon contained the 72 spirits of the brass vessel. Solomon ruled the jinn. And I don't mean 80-proof jinn, I mean, genie jinn. And, well, he might have ruled 80-proof jinn, too, if he could have had it. But Solomon... And Solomon as I said, is our avatar. Solomon and Melchizedek, those are our two avatars. Now, that's the biblical connection to this. So, what we needed to do, under the influence of Fred Adams' Farfaria, and, you know, oh boy, Fred Adams, there was a Western master. There was a Western master, if ever there was one. And I am so honored that I'm so honored to have been one of Fred's students and one of Fred's stalwarts, and still carrying on the Farfarian tradition, keeping it alive. Under Fred's influence, because Fred had this wonderful nine royal passions of the year, which, by the way, we send out that art folio of the nine royal passions of the year when you order our seasonal ceremony book. You associate members with your catalog sheets there now. You order that, and I'm underlining this, when you order the seasonal rites of Baal and Astarte and Prince of Cotton, the Magic Bow, you get a free copy of Nine Royal Passions of the Year, which is the Farfarian nine royal cycle, based upon Robert Graves' The White Goddess and so on. But anyway, Fred and Svetlana were doing these wonderful pagan seasonal ceremonies. I mean, just beautiful. And we were involved in it. And my wife Jeanette, Soror Artemis, said, Pope, we've got to have seasonal ceremonies. We've got to have seasonal ceremonies for Baal and Astarte. And I said, you're right. Well, at the time, I was struggling through the 7 years it took for me to get a master's degree in cultural anthropology from California State University in Northridge. But I had access, of course, to that wonderful library out there and all of the research. And so it was a good time to put together, along with study in cultural anthropology, it was a good time to put together seasonal ceremonies for Solomon's secret religion, for the religion of Baal and Astarte. So, could we do this? Well, yes, we could. And now, we actually couldn't do this. This couldn't have been done. 30 years before, it could not have been done. There was no way, if somebody wanted to do the Phoenician mysteries or Canaanite mysteries, if somebody wanted to do them back before World War II, they wouldn't have been able to. The reason is that in the late 1930s, around Ras Amra in Syria, there was an archaeological find, a huge Canaanite library from back in Melchizedek's time was discovered. And after World War II, the translations began to appear. And at that point, we were presented with what was really Canaanite mythology. Before that time, we didn't really know that much about it. We had a Greek, Syrian, kind of Neoplatonic philosopher, Sancho Neatho, who did a version of it, which seemed to be awfully Greekified, but it turned out later it was pretty close. But I mean, we didn't know, and so we had Sancho Neatho, and we had a few comments, and we did know something about the Adonia that I'm going to talk about tonight. The Adonia ceremony. We knew something about that. I'll tell you the reason why we knew something about it was the one ceremony, the death of the Ur King, that we knew about. And but we didn't know all of the details of the gods and the pantheon and the rest of it. But this Ugarit library that was dug up at Ras Amra, oh, gosh, just filled it all in. These are the stories of ancient Canaan. So there's a whole mythology here that comes alive. So with that, plus what we already knew about Adonia and Sancho Neatho and whatever, it was possible to reconstruct these seasonal ceremonies. Now, I want to point out, because There are a couple of folks out there, and you can find them on the internet, who have Canaanite temples on the internet, and who have reconstructed their version of it. I don't think they actually do them the way we do, but I mean they don't get out in the yard and actually do them. Maybe they do, I don't know, but they try to do it exactly the way they originally done. I don't think this works too well. I appreciate their attempt, and some of the websites they have are just beautiful, and I really appreciate the research, their attempt. But these ceremonies really kind of needed to be moved up to where we could relate to them. They needed to be put into the Hermetic tradition, and there's a number of reasons for this. When I wrote the cycle, I used the Chester Mystery Plays, from the medieval Chester Mystery Plays, sort of as my model. Because, I'm a Renfair type, I go out there and I like John Barleycorn and I like all this Elizabethan. I did a lot of Shakespeare when I was a kid, and I like the Renfair kind of approach. So what we've done is we've got the Canaanite religion, the ancient Canaanite religion, as it would have been if it had survived all the way into Elizabethan times. This is the way, this is the way it would be. And so our poetry and our delivery is more Elizabethan than Canaanite. Canaanite, they repeat everything three times. Doesn't matter what it is, they're going to repeat it three times, and that gets a little boring, and it's kind of hard for a dramatic presentation. So consequently, we also hermeticized it, because a Jewish Canaanite fellow, Steve Posch back east, who has a Canaanite a group. He pointed out to me, Poke, he said, they didn't do it on the solstices and the equinoxes. They did it on the plantings. I said, yes, Steve, I know that. But doggone it, we're plugging this into the Hermetic tradition. It's part of the big picture. And so consequently, we're gonna set it with the solstices and the equinoxes and make it alchemical and all the rest of that. So we understand. Yes, we understand. And good that you're being a purist, and I think that's fine. But anyway... So, I went ahead and I worked these things up, four of them. Now, the first one we did was the Dying God, the death of the Ur King. Now, let me explain a little bit about that, and that's the ceremony, by the way, that we know the most about, and it's the one that we know the most about. And in fact, actually, this ceremony was performed all the way up to 300 A.D. They were still doing it. And they were doing it in one of the most beautiful sacred sites, natural sacred sites in the world. This is the gorge of the River Ebrum in the Lebanon. And there is a grotto. There is a cave way up the canyon side. At the head of this gorge, there's this cavern, and the river, the waterfall, comes out of the cavern, and it tumbles down 1,000 feet into the gorge. And up there is where they had a temple of Astarte. And they had a temple of Astarte up there. That temple continued all the way from before Christ, all the way from almost from Melchizedek's time, all the way up to 300 A.D. And here's how this connects to the Holy Grail. Because, in our ceremony, when Baal goes around with the Great Grail Chalice, which, of course, is in the Rosh Hamra tablets, the cup to awe mortal men, and it's the great chalice. And he says, "Who drinks with me?" And then we sing, round and round the circle goes, while the sacred river flows, round and round the king we hail, till we've drained the Holy Grail. Now, why is this the Holy Grail? Okay, it's the Holy Grail because it really was the Holy Grail. If you read a classic anthropological treatise, which actually came out before the Rosh Imra tablets, as a book called From Ritual to Romance, jot that down, you scholars out there, From Ritual to Romance by Jesse L. Weston. That's Jesse L. Weston. This is a Dover book. You can get it. And it's been published many times. And basically what Jesse Weston is saying is that the original secret origin of the Grail legend, the medieval Grail legend, is that River Ebrum and that shrine of Astarte at Ephaca, where every spring they celebrate or lament the death of the Year King. Adonia, of course, Adon means Lord. And our chant, which has come down all the way from way, way back, Hoyahi, Hoyadon, Hoyahi, Hoyadon, alas, my brother, alas, my Lord. Now, the waterfall hits. And as it goes down the gorge, in the springtime, after the winter rains, in the springtime, it rises up to a hematite layer. And then it runs out to the sea, and it throws out a plume of blood-red water out into the Mediterranean. And this is the blood of the dying god. And this, according to Jesse Weston, is the origin of the European Holy Grail legend. Now, I wasn't totally convinced of that until I read the Rosh Imra text, which came out later. And here is Prince Baal with this awesome goblet filled with liquor, not wine, liquor. Oh, boy. And so we knew this was it. So we wrote this ceremony up, and that was the first one. And that was the one we had the most information on, because we had the legend. Now, one thing I want to mention before we get away from this too far is that I said this ceremony went all the way up there to Faka. It went all the way from Melchizedek's time all the way up to 300 A.D. And what happened in 300 A.D.? A Christian saint led a mob up there with clubs and cudgels and swords and pikes. And they slaughtered the pagan celebrants of the death of the Year King at Ephaca. And then the river ran with human blood. And they destroyed the temple. And that was the end. And that was the last of the Adonia rites. So, Hypatia wasn't the only pagan martyr. And as I said, this tradition went then, it from there, it went into the Grail tradition of Europe. And according to Jesse Weston, that's one of the reasons why the secret of the Grail was never discussed. He didn't want to talk about it, because this was something that happened. So consequently, this has a lot of history behind it, and it also connects, as I said. Now, this is not the only Hermetic Grail reference, non-Christian Grail reference. Parseval, which is one of the earliest of the Grail myths, the Grail is a is a green stone from the stars, and it's certainly not Christian. And, of course, in the Corpus Hermeticum, which we read to initiates, we discuss the great crater that is sent down in which the souls baptize themselves in wisdom. So the Grail has certainly a pagan, and in our case, a Solomonic tradition here. Now, so the first one we did was Adonia. Now, and it's still, I think, one of the most dramatic of the four. And what I would like to do, if I may, is I would like to just very briefly read you some of the lines from it, and some of the excitement of it, and see if maybe we can get that across. By the way, this last seasonal, I doubled up. I played Lord of the Vines, which is the priest, but I also, because of the way this ceremony is blocked, I could duck out when Baal comes in and serves everybody around the circle. I could duck out and assume the role of Moat, the Grim Reaper, the god of death, and come back in and slay the Ur-King. So I got to do two roles. Now, the prologue, which Merrick reads the prologue before we go in. What it does is it recaps the whole story in ritual form and sets everybody the mood. So I'll read. I know I can't do as good a job dramatically reading this as Merrick does, but I'll try. Okay. Adonia, the festival of summer solstice. The drama depicts the death of the Ur-King at the hand of the Dark Lord, opening the season of heat and dryness on the southern quadrant of the magic circle, which is ruled by the principle of fire and the philosophical element of sulfur, symbolizing calcination, first of the four primal operations of alchemy, accomplishing the purification of the spirit through sacrifice. Hearken unto the myth of the sacred year. It was written in the dawn of the days of the age of Ares, in the years when Melchizedek was priest king in Salem, a tale older than the walls of Jericho, of how Prince Baal, having conquered Lotan, the dragon of chaos in winter season, did free the sun to climb the heavens once more, and when the golden orb had risen to the ecliptic at vernal equinox, he took the fair Astarte to wife. And the earth did bloom with the promise of spring. And with the coming of summer solstice, when the blazing torch of the gods rides highest in the heavens, and the fruit ripens on the vine, Prince Baal is at the zenith of his power. Like the gentle rain and warming sun that cover the hills with green, the Prince of Earth brings heaven's blessing, a golden seminal sacrament of life, to the celebrants of his ancient rite. Such is the mystery of the Holy Grail. For the starborn crater is not filled with the wine of blood and death, but with the nectar of life, like unto the Zra, the solar lingam, symbolized by golden honey mead in the great chalice of the solstices. For it was written on the tablets of Ugarit that Father El gave to Baal Cloud Rider a holy cup, which the prince took in both hands, a goblet to awe mortal men. And after drinking therefrom, he rose and sang a song to his daughters, the holy maidens of morning dew and dawning light. But the Dark Lord Moat, bringer of death, who rules the gloomy desert beyond the gate of sunset and the caverns beneath the mountains of darkness, heard the great honors and gifts bestowed upon his brother, Prince Baal, and how the Cloud Rider did shower his largus upon the land of Canaan. The Lord of Death demanded tribute, and Baal, in his pride, refused. And so Moat turned the searing heat of the sun, torch of the gods, against his fortunate and generous brother, scorching the land with drought, drying the rivers and withering the vines. And then did Mote cut down the green man, Prince Baal himself, at the height of his reign, with the sickle of reaping. And the people mourned and cried lamentations, even to the heights of Mount Zaphon, where Father El held court. Even the king of the gods did mourn the passing of Baal with a great cry of anguish that shook the vaults of heaven. Fair Astarte, eternal daughter of El, the compassionate, and mother Asherat of the sea, she who was wife to Baal Cloud Rider, did then herself to earth descend to weep for the fallen prince and comfort the people with her promise to vanquish the dismal lord of darkness, restoring the green man to life in the season of return by the grace of the All-Father and the All-Mother through the alchemical mystery of the sacred year. So it was, so it is, and so shall it be. And then, of course, we all take hands. Now, this is a festival of light, solstice. So, everybody, if you've seen the Rites of Magic, you see this done, and it, we go across the bridge at Rivendell. And everybody carries a tea light, a lighted tea light, and we circle around the hands, and we put the little tea light floated in the Brazen Sea, which is a big copper bowl, and with water, so we can float these tea lights. And this is a very, very beautiful kind of a thing. So we do the chant, of course. Come and dance the circle round, the sun is high again. Hail the green man, cheerly gift, ripening the grain. Balsaphon, Balhadad, Balsaphon, Balhadad, Balsaphon, Balhadad. Lead us to the sacred ground, the summer has begun. Call the year king with his grail to serve us everyone. Balsaphon, Balhadad, Balsaphon, Balhadad, Balsaphon, Balhadad. Wind the circle round the henge in the solstice rite. Sing the hymn of olden time, praise the Lord of Light. And then we do this, we get around the circle, and we open the circle. And then, of course, we have an Orphic hymn, and that's sung by our operatic voiced singer, dear sister Hypatia. And that's a traditional Orphic hymn. And then, then I invoke Baal, and I got to blow this trumpet every year. Sometimes I almost do it okay, and then sometimes I sound like sometimes it's laughable, but I got to blow it. So I blow this trumpet, and actually it sounds better than the sofer, but then I invoke Baal. And the Lord of the Vines invokes Baal. Yearly king of fruitful furrows, dripping clouds so red and gray, tree-born lord in leafy raiment, sired by golden solar ray, thee we hail with scent of myrrh and old Sidera's sacred way. Come to us from far Afaka's spring and shrine and sacred tree, where roses bloom by lofty cedars, and a crimson river seeks the sea. Come ye forth, Lord Baal, your king, rain cloud rider, prince of earth. Pour for us the dew of heaven, holy Zra of life and birth. You notice in there I mentioned Afaka, and roses bloom by lofty cedars, and a crimson river seeks the sea. They're referring to that Afaka, where the original Astarte and Baal temple was. Well, anyway, Baal comes in, and so he has the goblet, this big huge goblet, and he fills it up with Oimalus, and Oimalus is of course that's 151 proof rum in equal portion with honey. Now we heat that honey up, and I put this 151 rum in there, and then we mix it up, and it's kind of like, it's a little better than Irish mist. It's about the same thing. And around we go, and then Baal pixel celebrant, and we all sing, round and round the circle goes, well, the sacred river flows, round and round the king we hail, till we drain the holy grail. And then Paul said, who drinks with me? We drink with thee. And then somebody drinks the chalice, and then we go, while they're drinking, we're clapping and going, Amalek, Amalek, and then they're drinking, and then round and round again, and we keep going until we get this whole thing. Then, you know, we're done. The ball turns the chalice upside down, and then the drum, boom-ba-dee-boom, 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 and Ball hears it. Who dares to roll the drum of battle? Who comes upon me from the north? I, Prince Baal, do call thee forth. And in comes Mote, who is wearing his skull mask and his bony hands and his sickle, and he says,
I am Mote, thy royal brother, Prince of Ruin, Death, and Gloom. Thou hast lived thy fruitful season. Now 'tis time to seek the tomb.
I want to say something about Mote here. Those of you who remember He-Man, Mattel's He-Man? Okay. Mattel's He-Man is based on Canaanite mythology. I know this because we had some designers from Mattel came to one of our Cecils one time, and they admitted it. They admitted that, yeah, they based He-Man and Skeletor and all the attorney of people, you know, Masters of the Universe. Great little film, too, if you want to see it. And that's all Canaanite mythology. So Mote is Skeletor. And, you know, Frank Langella did a wonderful job playing Skeletor. Much better than the guy on the radio did. But anyway, that's Mote Skeletor. And so then Baal, we circle around, and he whacks off Baal's sheaf of wheat, which Baal uses as a weapon. And, of course, Mote has the sickle, and he whacks it up. And then Baal finally falls, and then Mote has triumphed, he says.
He who mounts the clouds has fallen. He who brought the rain has died. Now the crops will parch and wither. Rivers, streams, and wells be dried. I have laid my curse upon thee, drought and famine evermore. Death and rot and dissolution. That is all thou hast in store.
And out he goes. So, Field comes in, she mourns Baal, and then she invokes Astarte, the goddess. Queen of heaven, fair Astarte, mistress of the evening star, wave-born goddess, dove of morning, hear us in thy land afar. Come to us on bright wings gliding, come to us on crested foam, bring to us thy love supernal from thine emerald palace home. Heed our call, O fair Astarte, consort of our dead Prince Baal. Lift the curse of Mote upon us. Shield us from the fires of Saul. Grace the land with milk and honey. Save the seedlings in the earth. Give us hope for all the future. Grant us life and love and birth. And then we have a gong. We're a little late on that cue on that one, but that's because... because Astarte didn't know which gong was she was supposed to ring. But anyway, so then we have a gong, and Astarte comes in. This time we had a lovely Lemurian priestess, Sister Clito, doing Astarte. So she comes in, and she grieves over Baal, and then she says, I've heard thy call, my children, but alas, she cried too late. Here I weep in mourning with you, and my lover surely fate. With him glows the bloom of springtime, with him pass the gentle rains. He alone could fruit the hillside, he alone could green the plain. Yet I am still the queen eternal, star-born daughter of great El. Seedlings slumber, yearlings prosper under my protecting In the autumn I do pledge thee war to make the dark lord yield. Armed with stock and stone to grind him, I shall cast moat to the field. Bearing with me heaven's nectar, I shall raise the dead Prince Mal to reign again in winter season with the waxing rays of Sol. Come ye now and mourn him with me. Burn away the blood-born rose. Purify the soul in sadness. Shed the tears of she who knows. So then we go on in, circle around, and put a rose petal on the fire, and then sprinkle a little lustral water on the fallen Prince Mal, and then Astarte says, each blood, each rose is the blood of the year king. Burn it in thy sorrows, be forgot. These waters, the tears of the goddess shed them, and thy sadness shall pass. So this becomes a very sad sort of a thing. And then, when everybody's all together, we circle back to the henge with, hail the longest, brightest day, mourn the passing rain, hail the ever-living queen, mourn the year king slain. And then it's the traditional dirge. Hoy-a-he, hoy-a-don, hoy-a-he, hoy-a-don, hoy-a-he, hoy-a-don. Trust the goddess to return, bringing down the grail. She will bear the cup of life, death will not prevail. Hoy-a-he, hoy-a-don, hoy-a-he, hoy-a-don, hoy-a-he, hoy-a-don. The green man's lying down below, our fields are parched and dry. In autumn time he'll rise again when thunder rolls on high. Hoy-a-he, hoy-a-don, hoy-a-he, hoy-a-don, hoy-a-he, hoy-a-don. And then the deacon performs a banishing pentagram ritual, and the rite is concluded. And we did this on the 18th, the evening of the 18th, with about 35 of us, and it was the 37th consecutive performance. We're going to continue to do these all the way up into the 22nd century and beyond, because this ancient rite and the other three in the cycle need to be continually performed. We feel that this is the magic behind Solomon. This really is the magic behind the Bible, even though a lot of rather fundamental people in both of all three biblical religions wouldn't want to admit that. But this is what lies behind it, and this connects us with nature. It connects us with our elemental spirituality. This is a very much an alchemical process, and that's one of the reasons why we connected it to the solstices and the equinoxes, because it is a hermetic, alchemical, celestial, eternal process. These are the rites of immortality. These are the rites of the most ancient tradition. So, Mike is out there doing one tonight over in Georgia, and I wish you luck and good magic. And Astarte bless. The rest of you out there that want to do these, you don't have to be as elaborate as we are. You can do them. You can double up on the parts. But the important thing is to do them. They're fun, and they're also very, very, very powerful. And you'll find once you start doing them, it'll, I think, make a difference in your life. Anyway, That's seasonal for this time. Next week, we're going to be back on next week. I think our little vacation notice, well, we may do that later on in the year, but we're going to be back next week, and hopefully next week we'll have a very, very special guest. And so, meanwhile, you guys take care, be well, and good magic, and we'll see you next week.